Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 689, Interview with Sterling Seagrave. This program is being recorded on September 13th of the year 2009, and it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring to our airwaves Sterling Seagrave, who, along with his wife Peggy, who has graced our airwaves before, it could be called, and I think is in fact, a genuine hero. Not just an American hero, but a hero of the human race. And that heroism comes by virtue of having authored some remarkable books. We've dealt with their book, The Amato Dynasty, in the past, and at much greater length we've dealt with a book that I consider to be one of the most important ever written, the book that will be the focal point of this broadcast, and that is Gold Warriors. Sterling, thank you so much for the book, and welcome to our airwaves.
Pleasure, Dave.
And it might seem a little bit embarrassing, but after what you and Peggy have been through and for what you have revealed to us, you just deserve all of the kudos and all of the congratulations and all the praise that could possibly be directed to you.
That's very kind of you, but we came upon it all by accident. It wasn't something that we set out to do.
Well,
very often, you know, when you're doing research on a family, you find things that have been hidden for centuries or decades. And that takes you off onto a tangent where you begin to discover mischievous behavior.
Well, you've discovered quite a bit of it. Sterling, why don't we start with what could arguably be called the beginning of this episodic journey that began accidentally. And if you want to relate to us how it began accidentally, that would be fine. What was Golden Lily?
Let me go back a little bit before that to explain to your listeners that my family's lived out in Asia for six generations. Teachers, doctors, things like that. And so we got a different perspective on what was happening in Asia compared to the way Americans looked at it from the U.S. So Golden Lily is a very, very strange story. It's all about stolen treasure. But stolen treasure, people have been stealing treasure for hundreds, thousands of years. To answer this, we really have to step back and compare, for example, the Japanese army with the Nazi army. Most people are aware in the West that the Nazis looted Europe, but the looting went on for less than 10 years. Very few people in the West are aware that the Japan began its conquest of the mainland of Asia in 1895. Way back when it assassinated the Korean king and queen and seized the country. So by 1945, when the Second World War ended, Japan had been looting treasure for 50 years, five times as long as the Japanese, as the Nazis. In the beginning, Most of the loot was kept by the Japanese army and the bankers and businessmen and gangsters who kept what was best and passed on a little bit to the Japanese Imperial Army. By 1937, the Japanese were ready to strike south and seize all of China, which, of course, was filled with treasures going back thousands of years. This time, the imperial family wanted to keep tight control of all looted treasure. So in 1937, this was the year of the Nanking Massacre, they set up an organization called Golden Lily, the name taken from a poem by Emperor Hirohito. Hirohito put his brother Chichibu in command, and his cousin Takeda, Prince Takeda, was chosen to be in charge of keeping track of the loot and finding places where it could be hidden. By 1943, the Japanese were in control of half of China and all of Southeast Asia. But U.S. submarines were making it impossible to ship the treasure to Japan. So Prince Takeda had a lot of it hidden in the Philippines, planning to recover it later. They actually had the idea that they could make peace and keep the Philippines as part of Japan, which would have made it easy. On the contrary, didn't work out that way, but they found other ways to recover the loot. So that's the origin of Golden Lily.
Now, obviously, the Japanese were not able to keep the Philippines, at least not formally, as part of their empire. And my laughter here really reminds me, Nietzsche had a phrase I like, a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. The U.S. military obviously won the Battle of the Philippines. They occupied the Philippines. And in a sense, your story really begins, or the story of Golden Lily and what came after, really begins to develop momentum when General Edward Lansdale moved into the Philippines and General Yamashita's driver was captured and tortured. Tell us about Lansdale, the torture of Yamashita's driver, and I can't remember all of his names, but Severino Jesus Garcia de Santa Romana, and who he was.
Quite a few.
Yes, he did.
Okay. Back at that time, Lansdale was not a soldier or a secret agent. He was an advertising copywriter in San Francisco. And his job during World War II was writing propaganda for the OSS against the Japanese. He didn't have any combat experience. And when the war ended, the OSS was closed down by Truman, but a lot of its people were moved to other jobs in order to, you know, hang on to their skills. Lansdale was moved to counterintelligence in the Philippines. And when he got there, he heard about a Filipino secret agent named Santa Romana working for the Vatican, apparently Opus Dei. And this Santa Romana was, at that time, he heard, torturing a Japanese major who had been chauffeuring General Yamashita all over the northern end of Luzon during the last months of the war. This Santa Romana wanted to know. He wanted to torture Major Kochima into revealing the locations of 12 secret hiding places that he'd driven the general to in the closing months of the war so the general could sign off on them. Essentially, Lansdale suggested bribing Kojima instead of torturing him. Any advertising man would guess that.
Sure.
So that worked. And Kojima took them to 12 different stashes in caves and tunnels in the north of Luzon. At this point, of course, Lansdale had to report to General MacArthur and also go back eventually to Washington to report to the chiefs of staff and to President Truman, all of which he did. The amount of treasure that they saw in these 12 stashes was 2 meters tall, 20 meters long, and in rows of about 6 to 8. Now, if you consider how much that is in gold bars, that's pretty incredible.
And so these were lots that were roughly 6 feet tall, because Americans are, of course, not on the metric system yet, roughly, 60 feet long and in lots of 6 to 8?
Exactly. There were billions and billions of dollars worth of gold. And this stuff, although most of it was cast in ingots that were pre-war, you know, all sorts of strange ingots. The Burmese did it one way, the Cambodians did it another. In the end, if you added it all up, it would be a mind-boggling amount of money. And eventually Marcos did, President Marcos of the Philippines, did have most of it recast to London Gold Standard, which means 999.9% pure. And at that time, he had to hide it because the U.S. wanted it. Various U.S. presidents tried to con Marcos into relinquishing his gold, the gold that he'd discovered from the Japanese hiding places, and he wouldn't do it without U.S. debt bonds. Okay, and that's another story, but we'll get to that in a minute.
All righty. Now, one thing I want to interject at this point, Sterling, we should remember as we speak on September 13th of 2009 that when we're talking about billions, if I remember correctly, the amount that was estimated to be in the Philippines was $100 billion in early 40s dollars. And that this would be...
Yeah, but that's quite a bit different from the value of them now because, of course, the dollar has inflated hugely.
As has gold, which is one of the things I wanted to mention. As we're speaking, gold has now topped $1,000 an ounce. So even since your book was written, the actual amounts of capital that we're going to be talking about in this discussion and that you and Peggy have written about in the book is literally exponentially larger and consequently more, more powerful, more significant than it was when your book was written.
Well, exactly. And it's difficult for people to comprehend how much value that is because the Federal Reserve in the U.S. was created in 1913 under President Wilson. And since then, it's been impossible to measure exactly how much a dollar is worth.
And one of the things, too, before we actually begin the enumeration and the outlining the history of how these funds developed and how they really signified and controlled in many ways or underwrote, served as the foundation of Cold War politics. We're talking about wealth that was looted prior to and during the Second World War and which really, in a very fundamental way, has served as a dominant, if not the dominant, element in the post-World War II economy running right up through the present.
Well, one of the reasons for that is because the U.S. is seen as the great victor of World War II. You know, certainly in terms of Japan, but on the other hand, the Nazis were the first into Berlin. So,
the Russians
were first into Berlin.
Right.
And so it's a little bit difficult deciding who was the victor of what, but the U.S. does a better publicity job. And as a consequence, people take the U.S. dollar very seriously. They believe that the dollar is exactly what it's represented to be. And it isn't because in 1913... the currency in the United States was turned over to private banks. There are about six or seven banks that own the private stocks of the Federal Reserve. So how can you possibly hold the government to take or to task for evaluating what the Federal Reserve is pumping out? The Federal Reserve can print as much money as it wants. It's monopoly money.
And
at least it was until a certain point when Nixon declared that it was no longer valued against gold. He took it off the gold standard, and he pulled a funny trick in order to get elected, which was to trade Okinawa to the Japanese for a great deal of money to help his election campaign.
You write about the Nixon deal, which I'd like to go into more about, which I'd like to go into more detail in a minute. But one of the things that grew out of Golden Lily, one of the things that grew out of Lansdale's bribing and interrogation of Yamashita's driver, was the creation of a number of funds and trusts that have grown out of this concatenation that we're talking about. I think, Sterling, to make this clear to the audience so that they can begin to follow this Ariadne's thread, which is going to go through the maze that you and Peggy have traced for us, getting some of these names under our belt, I think, would be an important thing to do at this time. And I'm going to ask you to do what is perhaps impossible past a point, but to try to encapsulate these things. What, to the extent that one can do it, how would you encapsulate, how would you explain the Black Eagle Trust?
Okay. It's actually not as difficult as you think. The Nancy Black Eagle Trust was named after the Black Eagle, which was the symbol of the treasury of the Nazi Party. And after the war, a number of U.S. units found, you know, treasure, loot, hoards of paintings, gold bars, gold bullion, hidden in caves, mostly in the salt mines down near Salzburg in Austria. And this was given a name, the Black Eagle Trust. This was to be used secretly to finance what eventually became the Cold War. It wasn't revealed to the public that all this stuff was found. For example, when a huge quantity of gold was found in one of the salt mines near Salzburg, it was put on a train and it was supposed to go to, I think, to Hamburg, to the Max there. And instead it got hijacked, or allegedly hijacked, but it was hijacked by the U.S., and the U.S. tucked it away into the Black Eagle Trust. Well, after that, there were a number of trusts in Japan that were set up. The M Fund, the Curry, the Keenan Fund, the Yotsuyu Fund, the Showa Trust. And to explain these, they're just like the Nazi Black Eagle Trust. The difference is that the M Fund was named after General Marquardt to finance black operations in Japan. The Keenan Fund was named after a U.S. lawyer. He was the chief prosecutor of the War Crimes Tribunal in Japan. It was used to bribe witnesses. The Yotsuyu Fund was named for General Willoughby's fund for bribing gangsters to work for the U.S. Army.
By the way, Sterling, let's very briefly fill the audience in on who General Willoughby is. Not a household name, but one of the most important names in the Pacific theater in the second half of the 20th century, General Charles Willoughby. Would you like to encapsulate him for the audience? You want me to do that? Because he's a very important guy.
Can do.
Go ahead.
Willoughby was a pet of General MacArthur. MacArthur was the son of one of the generals who seized the Philippines from Spain during the Spanish-American War. And after he graduated from West Point, he was made aide-de-camp to his father. One of his aide-de-camps was General Willoughby, who was the offspring, how shall I put it, of an American girl and a German count. The German count wouldn't honor the child. So he went off to the United States and eventually ended up going to various colleges, military school, and becoming a pet of General MacArthur. MacArthur was an extreme right-wing politician, and he was part of President Hoover's group, So when President Hoover lost the presidency to Roosevelt, Willoughby and MacArthur were moved to the Philippines by Roosevelt just to get them out of the city. In the end, Willoughby ended up being the head of counterintelligence for MacArthur. As a consequence, when the war was over and MacArthur was the shogun in Tokyo, General Willoughby ended up being in charge of bribing all the Japanese gangsters to work for the U.S. Army.
By the way, Sterling, very briefly, Willoughby also had as his political idol Francisco Franco, was described by MacArthur, who was no day at the beach himself, as you've mentioned, as my very own Junker general and a quote fascist, unquote. And when somebody was called a fascist by Douglas MacArthur, I think you could put that in the bank.
Well, it was MacArthur who called Willoughby my favorite fascist.
Yep, that was exactly it, my favorite fascist. So this is the guy who was in charge of military intelligence for MacArthur and whose imprimatur was put on an awful lot of the events that we're talking about. So
and
again,
Willoughby was apparently a really incompetent guy, but he was so MacArthur was so fond of him that he supported everything he did. And what that meant is that after MacArthur got into Tokyo as the new shogun, Willoughby was given command of getting all the gangsters out of the prison and to work for the USA, for the U.S. Army, or for the CIA. And this included the biggest gangster in Japan, Yoshio Kodama, who ended up working for the CIA for the rest of his life.
By the way, Kodama was also one of the linchpins of the Unification Church, which wields great influence today. Go ahead, Sterling.
They love church. You know, it sounds so good.
It does.
The other one you asked about was the Showa Trust.
Right.
The Showa Trust is actually the one that was set up by MacArthur for Emperor Hirohito. The deal was that MacArthur would provide Hirohito and his family with security for the rest of their lives. And so the Showa Trust, Showa is named after the reign period of MacArthur, of Hirohito. And it became, over a period of years, one of the biggest trusts in Japan. In fact, is now said to be the biggest by far, worth over $1 trillion.
The M Fund. Now, this is something that you touched on earlier, and I'd like to develop Richard Nixon's involvement with that at greater length in the Okinawa Exchange. The M Fund in many ways has dominated Japanese politics in the post-war period, and I'd like to discuss that and the Liberal Democratic Party, which is a name that probably would be misunderstood by the average American political analyst because it was anything but liberal or democratic. But the M Fund and the LDP, and perhaps mentioning a little bit about the Kenan Fund, which was to basically exonerate Japanese war criminals, because one of the things that you chronicle in Gold Warriors, one of the things that you chronicled at considerable length in your previous volume, The Yamato Dynasty, was basically the sham with which the, quote, political reconstruction, unquote, of Japan, the sham that was the political reconstruction of Japan. If I could ask you, Sterling, to try to not only talk about the M Fund, but how that served as sort of the economic glue for the political inertia which projected the Japanese war criminals, the Japanese imperial establishment into the post-war, quote, democratic, unquote, period.
Okay, it's a little bit tricky because, you know, after Hoover lost the presidency, Roosevelt took over, and that was considered to be a socialist regime. So when the war came, there were a lot of arguments over how you did this, how you did that. MacArthur, and a number of the other people associated with MacArthur in the Far East, including Willoughby, were really pretty fanatical right-wingers. I mean, can't fault them for that. Everybody's got their failings. But in any case, Marquardt was the guy who was behind General Marquardt, the guy who was behind financing all the black ops in China, in Japan. He was the economic specialist who was in charge of judging how much money the U.S. ought to give this group or that group in order to keep Japan on America's side and against the Russians and the Chinese, because they, you know, the for many, many years, the Japanese government had been afraid of being absorbed by the Russians, by the Soviet Union, and also possibly by the Chinese if Mao Zedong should win the Civil War. The outcome of this is that Marquardt financed the change in Japan between the socialist Japanese and the extreme right LDP. It wasn't called the LDP at that time. It was called several different parties. But after a few years, the Kenan Fund came in. Kenan was an American lawyer that Roosevelt hated, and he, you know, sent him out to the Far East in order to get rid of him from Washington. And he was the chief prosecutor in the Japanese War Crimes Tribunal. So the Kenan Fund was used to bribe witnesses. It was used to bribe Yoshio Kadama, the biggest gangster in Japan, to join the CIA. It was used along with the Yotsuya Fund, which was General Willoughby's fund, for bribing gangsters to work for the U.S. Army. And this was how, essentially, Yoshio Kadama ended up being the top gangster in Japan after World War II, after having been the top gangster in Japan before World War II.
We are almost out of side one. Tell people how they can get the book and about the bowstring.net, is it, website?
Yeah.
Tell us about the website.
Okay. Well, it's just a simple way for people to buy copies of our book or get copies of the CDs that we use to contain all of the documentary background.
Definitely. There are two data CDs that come with the book. And
no, There are three now because we keep adding to it.
Okay, so now there are three.
The documentation that goes with the book keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
All righty. Well, you've got three data CDs, and the book is Gold Warriors. We're speaking with one of the authors, Sterling Seagraves, and along with his wife, Peggy, the authors of that book and the preceding volume, The Yamato Dynasty. We're going to talk more about Gold Warriors in Side 2 of the program. However, this concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 689, interview with Sterling Seagraves. This is being recorded on September 13th of 2009. For Sterling Seagraves, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.